And Abbott told him, well, Bill has got to go there to Mars. And told Bill, why don't you fly with him? So they did. They got on here, got on this plane going to Vermont, this little trip. And it happened to be the first airplane that ever was going to come into this airfield. And some of the local citizens knew about it, and they had a little parade and stuff out there for the airplane, the first plane to come in. And here Bill and Eddie fell off the thing drunk, couldn't even walk. It was a little place called Manchester, and Charlie and I had was a wonderful opportunity 2 or 3 weeks ago to go to Burlington, Vermont, and we drove all the way down to East Dorset, where Bill's home was, and we went through Manchester, and it's just a little village. But just to think, you know, all the things that happened there with these guys. So Abby, he and Abby had been through these things again. He knew about Abby's situation. Now he said the door opened and there he stood, first skinned and glowing. There was something about his eye when he was inexplicably different. Bill always said that Abby was totally different. What had happened? He said, I pushed his drink across the table, and he refused it. No, if you would have to really know how Eddie's reputation, you know. And Bill said, disappointed or curious, I wonder what had got into this fellow. He was himself. Come, what's this all about, I queried. He looked straight at me. Simply, but smiling, he said, I've got religion. You know, you just think somebody, you know, one of your best people that you've been drinking with, and you push a drink across the table from him, and he looks at you, and he don't take the drink, and he say, hey, I've got religion. You know, you want to know what the hell's going on. And this was, because you remember now that Abby was in the Oxford groups, and the Oxford groups program at this time was not God as you understand him. It was a religious message in a way. That Abby brought to Bill. It wasn't our God as you understand him, it was God as I understand him. Okay. He said, I was a guest. So that was it. Last summer, a little alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspect a little crack about religion. He had a sorry eye. Look, yes, the old boy was on fire, but bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. And Bill said, hey, this guy was an alcoholic nut. Now he's just a religious nut. You know, he didn't really, you know, he wasn't serious about what Eddie was saying whatsoever. Well, he didn't know that. As a matter of fact, he told me how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told him of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked.
Now, I think here's where Bill learned the other two pieces of the puzzle. See, he had already learned about the disease from Dr. Silkworth, but he'd then been unable to do anything about it because he didn't have any place else to go, didn't know what the solution is. And Eddie brought him a simple religious idea, which turns out to be step two. Came to believe in a power greater than herself. He said, Bill, I've been going to the Oxford groups, and there I've learned about this thing called a spiritual experience, during which we find a power greater than human power, and we can overcome this disease. And he said, now, in order to find that power, there's a little program of action that the Oxford groups have given to me. And he said, I've been following that practical program of action, and I have found the power, and I don't have to drink anymore.
Sure.
So he brought him the practical program of action also, which turns out later on in our program to be steps 3 through 12, the last 10 steps. So now then, Bill knew all three things, and probably he was the first human being in the world to know all three of these things together at one time. He said he had come the passage of spirits along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside.
Mm-hmm.
There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings, his insistence that the Spears really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen, his fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up in the past and they made me swallow hard. And we can see that Bill's ideas concerning religion had mainly come from his grandfather. And his grandfather didn't want anything to do with organized religion. His grandfather questioned anybody's right to tell him how he must believe. And Bill, of course, had picked this up from his grandfather. He said, I'd always believed in a power greater than myself. I'd often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are. For that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had a little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much of precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation. But that was as far as I had gone. With ministers and the world's religions, I parted right there, just like his grandfather had. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ I conceded the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him, his moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded.
I love it.
Now, I don't know about you all, but I don't have any trouble identifying with Bill Wilson. Now, in the middle of that page, it says, but my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. That he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously, it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and this was none at all. This is where this identification process is so important. If we can convince a newcomer of our absolute powerlessness over alcohol, then when we begin to talk about these spiritual matters, the finding of the power greater than human power, it makes sense. Bill knew about Ebbie, and he knew how Ebbie drank, and he knew Ebbie was powerless over alcohol. So evidently something had taken place in Eddie's life. Some power greater than Eddie. Bill don't know what that power is, but he can see that something had taken place. Page 12. Still didn't like this God idea. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature. But I resisted the thought of the czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked to scores of men who felt the same way. And evidently Bill and Abby sitting there, and they're kind of arguing about this deal. You know, Abby talking about God in very religious ways, Bill fighting against that idea, admitting there might be a universal mind or spirit of nature, but certainly not a God who would be personal to him. And apparently Eddie got tired of it. Eddie finally said, my friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And if you'll notice, that is in italics. We call that squiggly writing. And when you see something in squiggly writing in the big book, stop and read it again. It's usually very, very important. Now, the instant Eddie said this, his message changed from a religious message to a spiritual message. See, religion says, this is how you got to believe in God. And each religion is a little different. But spirituality says it doesn't make any difference how you believe in God as long as you believe. So when he said, well, Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God? He changed from religion to spirituality right there. And Bill said that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I'd lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might believe what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Surely, this is when Bill took step two.
Yeah.
Came to believe that a power greater than himself could restore him to sanity. Came to believe that this spiritual thing could restore him and he could recover from the disease of alcoholism. If you'll notice also, he says, upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might do what I saw in my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the start of a little parable. Bill's going to paint a picture in our minds all the way through the book. And the picture is going to be of a spiritual structure. And he's going to tell us repeatedly that we're going to pass through that spiritual structure to freedom.
Yeah.
And this is the first reference to the spiritual structure. Willingness to believe, which really comes through step one, becomes the foundation of that spiritual structure.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've laid the foundation. If we become willing to believe in a power greater than ourselves, not God, a power greater than ourselves. Joe?
Okay. Now we can see if Bill had taken step one and now Ebby gets him to come to believe. He says, thus I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes, and a new world came into view. So now, Bill, let's take a step two. It wasn't written yet, but the concept, he's taking the concept of it. Beautiful way. Now, he still, remember, he is in the grips of the drunk he's on. He started drinking November the 11th, and this is the last of November. He's been drunk about 3 weeks. And the type Bill was, if you read Pass It On, I know I did for many years. I read the big book, and then after I read Pass It On, where someone else is talking more plainly about Bill's drinking life, I really got a different impression. You know, Bill was in bad, bad shape. But this, you know, he wasn't a little bit alcoholic. I mean, he was older, and he was very progressive. You know, he was chronic alcoholism. Okay, now so he's on a 3 week drunk at his stage, and the shape he was in is a bad drunk. He started. Immediately, after he took step two, he started trying to go to some meetings with Ebby. Ebby carried him some meetings, but Bill was drunk. Bill was drinking. He couldn't get, the craving had him. He couldn't get off the alcohol. Several times, Bill would show up at a meeting drunk. And on one particular night, he was going to some meetings and he had to go through some places where some bars were, quite a few bars in this area. And Bill got to the meeting. He was he met this one guy in the bar. He was a Finnish sailmaker. And he's sitting on the bar telling this guy about this Oxford group meeting he was going to and how much it was helping him. He's drunk. And this guy listens to it and he says, you know, that sounds good. He's drunk too, so I believe I'll go with you. So both of them went down to the Bowery to Sam Shoemaker. What the Oxford group meeting was, and they was in drunk, and Ebby had to get both of them and carry them back in the kitchen and give them some coffee and some sandwiches and talk to them and try to sober them up. You know how we do a drunk. And they said Ebby said Bill went back after this period of time. He went back into the meeting and he made the greatest witness he had ever heard, you know, drunk. They would witness, that's what they called it in those days. And they said, for some reason or other, Bill didn't, after he left the meeting, he didn't drink on the way home. In fact, this was just 2 or 3 days before he got all the way down and had to go back in the hospital for the last time on the 1st of December back at the town's hospital for his last time. And he said he went back to the hospital, and he said, at the hospital, I was separated from alcohol the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. You know, he drank all the way through this drug, drank himself almost right into DTs. He said, and after he was real, he had a real tough time at the hospital, by the way. And he said, there, when they had to visit him at the hospital. Now, he said, there I humbly offer myself to God, as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I place myself unreservedly under his care and directions. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, and without him I was lost.
Now surely, this is when Bill took step three. No step three written in those days. But here's where he made a decision to turn his will and his life over the care of God as he understood him at that time.
He says, I ruthlessly faced my sins.
This must be step four. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of himself.
Okay. And became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since.
This has got to be step six and seven. Became entirely willing to have God remove these things and humbly ask him to do so.
My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
This has got to be step five, where he admitted to God himself and another human being, Ebby, the exact nature of my wrongs.
We made a list of people I had hurt and to whom I felt resentment. I expressed my will to approach these individuals admitting my wrongs.
This must be step eight. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all.
Never was I to be critical to them. I was to write such matters to my utmost ability.
Got
to
be step nine. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others.
I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense thus would become uncommon sense.
That looks like step ten. Continue to take personal inventory.
I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction or strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except for my request bore my usefulness to others. And then only might I expect to receive, and that would be in the great measures.
You know, think here we see step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out.
My friend promised, when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, and I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems.
This must be step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps,
which is a new relation with our Creator as a result of these steps. Now, we can see, actually, and I don't think a lot of the people realize, I get kind of squeamish when I read this. But here's a man, here's a guy that, remember when this was written. This was written in 1937. This happened in 1934. And he was in his mind of what happened to him. He wrote this down 3 years later in 1937. And we can see, he took the steps in 1934. He wrote the steps. He wrote taking the steps in 1937. He didn't write the steps until a year later, 1938. Yeah. But this is why he said, these are the steps we have taken. Because he had taken them many years earlier, before they was written. All this was written and proved before it was given to us. You know, it wasn't given to
turning all things to the Father of life who presides over us all. Oral alcoholic, in order for us to recover, we have to give up the two things we hold nearest and dearest to our heart. First is alcohol. The second is self-centeredness. Very, very simple idea, but extremely difficult to do. Bill said these were revolutionary and drastic proposals. But the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I'd never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Now, Bill thought he was going crazy. He said, for a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I was still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head saying, something has happened to you I don't understand, but you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. Now, we don't know what happened to Bill that day. We were not there to see that. But we do know this. This was probably December the 11th, 12th, 13th, somewhere in that area. And we do know that Bill didn't die until January of 1971. And we know that Bill never had to take another drink as long as he lived, from 1934 until 1971. Something profound took place in his life that day. He always said that he had a spiritual experience as the result of this course of action that was brought to him by Ebbie from the Oxford groups. A couple days later, Ebbie comes back and visits with Bill again. And he hands Bill a book and he said, Bill, I haven't read this book, but you may find something there that would interest you. And the book is The Variety of Religious Experiences by William James. And through the reading of the book, Bill found an example that just exactly matched what had happened to him, validated for him that he had had a vital spiritual experience. Another miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got that book at home today. I've been sober 22 years. I can't read the damn thing today. It is written in psychiatric terms. I have no idea, but Bill found himself, and he'd just been sober 3 or 4 days when he did so, and validated that he had had a vital spiritual experience. Now, surely, if we're a new alcoholic down here in Georgia, and if we didn't have this wonderful fellowship as we have it today, and if we'd never been in contact with any of this first 100 people, and we get a copy of this book, and we begin reading the book in the front, and we've read the doctor's opinion, we've been able to see the physical allergy, we've been able to see that obsession of the mind, and if we've read and identified with Bill Wilson, and if we've seen Bill affect your recovery, then surely we can begin to believe that if this guy could recover, then maybe we could too. And that's exactly what Bill's story does, a classic example of what they call the visit, or what we would call today a 12-step call. I can almost see Bill as he finishes up this chapter, setting back, reviewing what they've done up to this point. And I can see him saying to himself, you know, they're not going to like this idea of this great spiritual experience, the great clean wind of a mountaintop that blew through and through any more than I did. And he said, maybe I'd better get down to practical terms and tell them just exactly what did take place in my life. He wrote another chapter. He called it, There Is a Solution. Here he's very well described the problem. Now then he's going to give us the solution. And remember, Bill had two things going for him. He had fellowship with Ebbie Thatcher. One drunk sharing with another drunk. He had the fellowship of people in the Oxford groups, even though they might not have been alcoholics. And Bill drew some strength from that. Bill also had the vital spiritual experience, which brought about the change in attitude that allowed him to recover. And he's going to devote this next chapter to talking about these two powers, the power of the fellowship, the power of the vital spiritual experience. Those two powers added together would surely give any of us enough power to recover from our powerlessness over alcohol if we could receive them both in our life. Bill explains them in great detail in the next chapter, Joe.
Chapter 2, There Is a Solution, and now we're going to be looking at the solution, our step 2, power. We of Alcoholics Anonymous have thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. Now he's going to begin to describe that power, and he's talking about the fellowship. We are average Americans. He's talking about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time and today, too. It's the very same thing, average Americans. All sections of the country and many of his occupations are represented. We come from all over the country in this group here today, and we have many different occupations. Are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of all different kinds of people, different walks of life, different races, different social backgrounds, different economic backgrounds, different nationalities, different religions. And we see how people come together, so we stop to see what brings people together in a group. We're talking about a support group here, or any group of people that come together. They usually have something in common. Like in a family, they have a common bloodline. That brings those people together. Sometimes in a common cause, like in a union, or a common belief, they belong in the religion, that brings people together. There's something that always in common that brings people together. The usual thing that brings people together we'll mention here. Religion, it's common, like a religion, they have a common religion, a common cause, a common social background, a common economic background, but none of those things exist today in this group. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is a mixed up group of people, a strange group of people. It's probably the most mixed up group of people in the world. Because this group here crosses all lines. It crosses all social backgrounds, all religious backgrounds. In fact, if we didn't talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, if we took the big book out of our midst this weekend, I doubt if we could carry on a decent conversation. I mean, we're so strange. So this is a unique group of people. He says, we are people who normally would not mix. And this is true. None of us should have no reason to ever known the other. We're different. But there exists among us, I love this, a fellowship and a friendliness and understanding which is indescribably wonderful. There is something here, even though we have never known each other. And he describes it, he says, we are like the passengers on a great liner, and Bill liked to use illustrations to teach, to get his point over. And he said, we are like the passengers on a great liner. The moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, George, and Marcus pervade the vessel from the steerage to the captain's table. And here, you know, this is a very classic illustration in those days, because the way we traveled to Europe on the great ocean liners. And on the great ocean liners, all the people were separated on the liners by the social background, by the economic background, and by religious background. Now this separated people. People were separated on that vessel. And you know, if you had the wrong social background, the wrong economic background, you were down in the steerage section. That was the cheapest way to travel. And way down there, you had everything wrong. I mean, if you were down there, you didn't have no money. Those are the immigrants probably coming over on the liners. They were in the bottom of the vessel. They couldn't see out and was in the air down there. And it was hot and was noisy.
Cheese sandwich section.
Cheese sandwich, you probably, yeah. But as things got better, as your economics got better and the religion got better, you'd move up deck to deck. When you got on the uppermost decks where all the finery was, everybody up there was the right classy people, the classiest of people. I'm talking about the old money was up there, not, you know, those people up there had the old money, and it was class up there. And they had one huge table in the dining room where the captain sat. And all the distinguished people could sit at this particular table as they went around the table closest to the captain on down this long table. And the man at the captain's table should have never met this guy in the steerage section in this journey through across the ocean. Just like none of us should have ever met each other in the journey of life. We should have never mixed. But during a moment of disaster in on the vessel and in our lives, we're here because of that. I always think about and look at that, the Titanic. I want to hear this story and see that night they hit the iceberg and the guy from the captain's table had probably had on his tuxedo and he jumped overboard and this guy from the steerage section had his blue jeans on. He jumped overboard. And as soon as they hit that water, they had something in common. When they hit that icy cold water, they had a common problem. And I'm sure that guy at the captain's table didn't ask that guy where he worked. He didn't have time to ask him where he went to church. I mean, they were trying to save their lives. And this is the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't care who you are, where you work, where you came from. We are here because of one thing that binds us, a common problem. And there's a lot of strength in that. There's a lot of power in this fellowship. You know, it is a support group. There's a lot of strength in being with other people who have recovered. And this is a very powerful thing. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous itself has a lot of power. We know that. But so that is the first power. That is support for the new person. When he's got to draw strength and hope from the new, from us when he comes among us. And he goes on to tell us, unlike the ship's feeling of the ship's passenger, our joy and escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. You know, I'm sure when those people got off the vessel, they went back to their ways of life. But we will always be alcoholics. The feeling of having shared a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us. And he tells us now, this is great, but this is just one element of this power. This is just one part of it. And I think sometimes we missed the boat on that. We've here lately, you know, because I guess the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is a visible thing. It's something that we can see. You know, we can visualize that. We can kind of touch that. It's a physical thing. And we put a lot of emphasis on the fellowship now. Just go to meetings, you know, just go to meetings in 90 days and you'll get sober. That's all you got to do. We don't tell these new people but one part of this thing. And I think that's what we're beginning to get off the real recovery. You know, we just can't get sober by going to meetings alone. It takes more than that. I always like that, but it's like you can't become a parent by going to PTA meeting. I mean, you have to take some other steps, you know. Recovery will not come simply by just going to meetings alone. That's just one element in the cement that binds us. He goes on to say, but that would have never held us as we are now joined. You know, as we said, the Washingtonians had a great fellowship, but they didn't have a program. They didn't have a planned program to find that we have. He goes on to say, to the tremendous fact for every one of us that we have discovered a common solution. Not only do we have a common problem, what really binds us in this room today is we have a common solution. We have a way out, which we can absolutely agree, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries for those who suffer from alcoholism. And the great news this book carries is a common solution, not the fellowship. And later on, a few more pages, in page 25 of the book, he's going to break that common solution down and tell us that the common solution is a vital spiritual experience. So right on this page, he's told us what this power is. The power of the fellowship, which comes from being around other people and being with other people. And the power of the spiritual experience, which comes as a result of the other steps. And as we practice these other steps, we will tap an inner resource of strength. So he's saying that our solution is the power of the fellowship, and the power of God that's within us that we will tap as a result of these steps. These two powers will overcome our powerlessness over alcohol.
I think this was really driven home to us. The first one of these we did in more or less a formal setting, the time we went to Lawton, Oklahoma. And just prior to going out there, I had had a little problem with my heart, and I wasn't sure we were going to get to go. And I remember Joe calling me, and he said, "Charlie, what do you think? Are they going to go?" And I said, "Well, Joe, we need to go. We've committed ourselves. We need to be there." He said, "Well, let me bring my car." And he said, "I'll drive up and pick you up." And he said, "I'll do all the driving, and you can rest." And I said, "Fine, that's great." Now, Joe drives from his home in Little Rock, Arkansas, to where I live, which is about 225 miles. Now, we get in his car at my house, and we begin to drive toward Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, you can tell by looking at us that we're people that normally would not mix. There is a little difference in us. He's bald-headed, and I'm not one of them. He's older than I am, too. And we ride up to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and there we pick up this guy named Tony, who had been sitting in with us from the very beginning. Now, Tony's name is Vargas, and he doesn't mind me breaking his anonymity. And we pick Tony up at the Camelot Hotel in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we start tooling it down the Turner Turnpike from Tulsa, Oklahoma to Oklahoma City. Now, the black guy's driving, the Mexican is riding shotgun, and the honky's laying in the back seat, sound asleep. When we get out to Lawton, Oklahoma, we're doing the big book study. We do this page that we just did. And I looked on the front row, and that whole front row was filled with Indians from the Anadarko Indian Reservation. That day, we realized what Bill's saying. We are people that normally would not mix with each other. But there does exist among us a fellowship which is indescribably wonderful. And if we aren't careful, that fellowship is so great that we begin to think that this is all there is to it. And we begin to try to stay sober just going to meetings only. And if we're just trying to stay sober, we're not recovering from alcoholism. Now, the only way we're going to recover from alcoholism is not only through the support of the fellowship, but do something about this personality change. And the personality change takes place through the use of the steps which results in that vital spiritual experience. I think one of the greatest tragedies in the world today, I don't care what else is going on, but one of the greatest tragedies is the fact that we in AA are spending literally millions of work hours, hundreds of thousands of dollars, trying to convince other people they ought to become members of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we've got thousands and thousands already in AA sitting around us dying from alcoholism every damn day of the week. Because they don't understand this. They've been told that 90 meetings in 90 days is all you need. They've been told that you can treat it as a cafeteria. Take what you want, leave what you want. They've been told that all you have to do is come to meetings and you'll be okay. I think our responsibility, and certainly your responsibility after this weekend, is to be sure every newcomer understands this page that Joe just talked about. This is our solution, not just the fellowship, but also the common solution. Those people who are participating in fellowship only, they are still running around with a bad case of untreated alcoholism, even though they're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not their fault. It's our fault. Nobody's telling them those things they need to hear. Nobody's taking them by the hand and walking with them through the steps. Nobody's sponsoring on a one-on-one personal basis like we used to. And that's our job to do those things. I think this is very important. The first half of this chapter, Bill devotes to explaining to us why the fellowship alone is not sufficient. And he does it by describing the alcoholic and by beginning to tell us what our real problem is and by showing us exactly why fellowship alone will not be enough. Let's go to page 20. Third paragraph on page 20. How many times people have said to us, "I can take it or leave it alone, why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fella can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him, but there he is all lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. Now, he's going to talk about two kinds of drinkers that those expressions would refer to. First, moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. We talked about them last time. They get a slightly tipsy, out of control, beginnings of a nauseous feeling. Alcohol's no big deal for them. If they got any reason at all, they can take it or leave it alone with no difficulty. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit bad enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. This guy we refer to as the heavy or the hard drinker. They drink like we alcoholics. But if a sufficiently strong reason presents itself, they will either stop drinking entirely or they will learn to moderate their drinking. They do not have the physical allergy. They do not have the obsession of the mind. And you and I see these people all the time. They're the ones that say, when I was in the service, I was an alcoholic also. But when I got out, I quit drinking, and I don't see why in the hell you can. No, they drink like us, but they are not alcoholic. But what about the real alcoholic? Now, he may start off as a moderate drinker. Many of us did. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. Many of us stayed periodics. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Now, here's a fellow who's been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He's seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tired at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. He's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then throws the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He's a fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. Yet early next morning he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house, but he gets certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. Then comes a day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and treatments, sanitariums. I have to remember they've changed the name of those places. They call them treatment centers today. They used to call them sanitariums, same kind of deal. Thank God that if our government has ever spent any money right in this alcoholism, it might be on the education of the public as to what alcoholism is and what it isn't. And because of that, we're getting many, many people into AA before they have to do all these things that Bill has just given as the description of the alcoholic. But I'll guarantee you, if you're a real alcoholic, you found yourself in there somewhere. At least one or two will fit every one of us. Most of them will fit us. One in particular fits me. He says, if he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him. After I'd been sober for about 6 or 7 years, I sold a 40-acre broiler chicken operation. Now, that's been several years ago. And today, once in a while, I see the guy that bought it. Sometimes he'll wave and he'll say, "Hey, Charlie, we have found another one." And he's referring to partially empty vodka bottles. They're behind corner posts, they're under rocks, they're in hollow trees, they're coming out of feed bins. God only knows where they are. And he's still finding them 14, 15 years later. Now, second paragraph, page 22. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that he one rate means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes that one rate? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? The moderate drinker can. The heavy drinker can. Why can't the alcoholic? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he acts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense that makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Now, these observations, the ones I just read, would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes the excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. As strange as it may seem, sometimes we alcoholics tell the truth. I had a lady ask me one time, her husband was still drinking, she was an Al-Anon. She said, "Charlie, all he does is lie, lie, lie." She said, "How can you tell when one of you guys are lying?" I said, "Lady, watch him closely. If you see his lips moving, he's probably lying to you." And then I said, "Do you want me to tell you how to keep him from lying?" She said, "Oh, yeah, yeah." I said, "Don't ask him those stupid questions." The truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses which are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are baffled on. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. Now remember, an obsession of the mind is an idea that is so strong it overcomes all ideas to the contrary. An obsession of the mind is an idea that is so strong that it can make you believe something that isn't true. The great obsession of every alcoholic is someday, somehow, we're going to find a way to drink without getting drunk. Someday, somehow, we're going to find some kind of liquor we can drink without getting drunk. Someday, somehow, we'll find a group of people we can drink with, and we damn near kill ourselves. The great obsession of every alcoholic, the real problem of the alcoholic, centers in the mind rather than the body. You know, my allergy can't hurt me if I don't take a drink. And I can't take a drink based on the truth. I have to believe a lie just before I drink. And I take the drink knowing that it's going to be okay. And then the drink triggers the allergy, and then I end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. Page 24, first paragraph, squiggly writing. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. You know, if you burned your hand on a hot stove, chances are you're not going to go back and put your hand on it again to see if it'll do it the second time. You know, I remember as a kid growing up during the Depression years, and we didn't have hot and cold running water. We didn't have forced air heat. If we had heat at all in the wintertime, we were lucky. Usually it was wood or coal. Joe said where he was from in Kentucky, they burned walnuts. And he said occasionally other people's houses. Whatever necessary. But I remember always, it doesn't make any difference how poor you are, you're still going to take a bath on Saturday night. Now whether you need it or not, beside the point, you're going to have a bath on Saturday night. And one winter, Mother had heated the bath water on that old heating stove in the living room, put it in a number 3 zinc wash tub behind the stove, and every kid takes a bath in it. Now, I'm the baby of the family. By the time it got to me, the crud would be about an inch thick, and Mother would say, get in there and get clean, and I'd think, how in the hell am I? But I didn't dare say anything to her. And that night, I got in that tub, and I was washing myself, and I'd been over, and I struck my rear against that red-hot stove. And it burned a blister on my rear end as big as my hand. It hurt me worse than anything that ever hurt me up until that time. And you know, I've never had an obsession in the mind to stick my ass on a hot stove. I've never jerked my britches down and backed up and said, burn me again. Now, alcohol has burned me over and over and over just as bad as that stove ever burned me, but left on my own resources, I can't remember that. And if I could see the jailhouse at the end of the drunk, I wouldn't take the first drink. If I could see that car wreck or that divorce court, I never would drink. But just before I drink, I can't see any of those things. My mind concentrates only on the sense of ease and comfort that comes from the first 2 drinks. It concentrates on what alcohol is going to do for me, not what it's going to do to me. And based upon that, it's impossible for me to stay sober, left on my own resources. Last paragraph, page 24. When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he's probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. If we've placed ourselves beyond human aid, then the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous will not bring about recovery, because the fellowship is made up of a bunch of humans who are just as powerless as we are. Page 25, there is a solution.
Okay. Now we're going to begin to look at the common solution of the real recovery.
We'll do spiritual experience and then we'll take a break, okay?
Almost none of us like the self-searching, leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others and have come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we've been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us to pick up the simple kit of spiritual truths laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence we had not even dreamed. The people in the fellowship brought to them the other recovery steps of the planned program of action. And this is the simple kit of spiritual truths. Now, the great fact is just this, and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experience as results of the use of these tubes. Which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life toward ourselves and towards God's universe. And this sounds like the psychic change that Dr. Silkworth was looking for. This simple kit of spiritual tools will bring about that psychic change. He said, the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and our lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could not never do by ourselves. We were powerless. And this power has done the things we could not do by ourselves. Now we see an asterisk there. It's very, very important to the book. Very, very important. And I tell them we'll overlook that asterisk. It's very, you know, as when the first book, the big red book was printed, first printing of the first edition, it didn't have an asterisk in it. It just said that, you know, to the new reader, no, I know alcoholics had no spiritual background. We come in this program with all kind of backgrounds in this area. Some of us don't really understand it. We're confused about it. I know I was. And they told the reader that he had to have a spiritual experience. It's a very lofty term and a real challenge for an alcoholic to have a spiritual experience. Many of the readers, after the book was printed, began to write into Bill and asked him about this. So, you know, this spiritual experience thing is kind of lofty, and it's kind of, what are you talking about? And so the first red book had a little blind spot in there to the reader about this. So Bill, when he reprinted the book, he put an appendix in the back of the book to explain what he was talking about when he used the word spiritual experience. What is a spiritual experience? He had to break that down to something easier for the alcoholic to understand. So he put that asterisk in the book, and if we follow that asterisk to the bottom of the page, it says, fully explained in Appendix 2. So if you would continue on with the book but not having a complete understanding of it, it kind of leaves a blind spot. So let's go to page 569 and see what is a spiritual experience. Now, if you're going to have one of those things, it's good to know what is it. Okay. This is very, very important to the understanding, the total understanding of the book, or to the rest of the program. It says the terms, the terms, plural. We're going to look at two terms. We're going to use spiritual experience and spiritual awakening. We can look at this in two ways. We can recover, this change can come about through a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening. And they are used to use many times in this book, which upon careful reading, and I think that's the trouble, most alcoholics don't do careful reading, shows that their personality changes sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism and manifest itself in us in many different forms. Now he's breaking it down to something that I can understand. He said spiritual experience or spiritual awakening brings about personality changes good enough to recover. Now I can understand personality changes good enough to recover. And he said this occurs in many different forms. It's not one way. But Bill said later there are spiritual experience and spiritual awakenings are just as different as our people in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an individual thing. It's not that only this occur one way. He goes on, yet it is true, our first printing, the big red book, gave many readings the impression that these personality changes, our religious experience, must be in the nature of a sudden spectacular upheaval. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. Now, this book gave the impression that everybody had to have a spiritual experience just like Bill in the town's hospital. And a lot of people, even yet today, still assume that. He said, in the first few chapters of the book, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described in Bill's story. He said, though it was not our intention to create such an impression,
Many alcoholics nevertheless conclude that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in his feeling and outlook. The other people reading this book had come to that conclusion, and he said, we didn't intend to give you that impression. He goes on to explain, he says, among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. You know, he talks about that Bill in talk with Dr. Thibault about this particular subject, spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, and his writings about it. He told Dr. Thibault that about 10% of the first 100 people had sudden spiritual experiences. That means 90% of them had other uncovered in another way. And today, you know, people still have sudden spiritual experiences, but most of us, that's by no means the rule. Most people will not recover that way. He says, most of our experiences are what a psychologist, William James, calls, and this is the variety of religious experience, calls the educational variety. Now, there's another way to recover. We call an educational variety. In this type, you will learn gradually, and as you learn, you will change gradually over a period of time. One is a spiritual experience, which is sudden. The other takes place slowly as you learn and apply the steps. And this was the way I recovered. Mine was not sudden. And this gradual type, educational variety.
On page 569, how many different ways he said it? First paragraph, he talked about a personality change sufficient to recover. Then he talked about, in the second paragraph, again personality changes. But then he said, in the nature of a sudden and spectacular upheaval. An upheaval is to change something. Third paragraph, first sentence, he called them sudden revolutionary changes. To revolutionize something is to change it. Third paragraph, last sentence, immediate and overwhelming God consciousness. To overwhelm something is to change it. Third paragraph, last sentence, vast change in feeling and outlook. Fourth paragraph, first sentence, such transformations. To transform is to change. Fourth paragraph, middle of the paragraph, profound alteration. So he said nothing other than what we need to do is change, a change in our personality, a change in our outlook upon life. Now, we can call it whatever we want. Psychic change, personality change, spiritual experience, spiritual awakening, all deal with the same thing. Now, the fellowship will not bring that change about. That change comes through the working of the program itself. That's how we have the vital spiritual experience. Now, back to page 25, last paragraph. If you're seriously an alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we'd passed into the region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could.
That's step one.
And the other to accept spiritual help.
Step two.
Bill is showing us now, giving us the final decision that we're going to have to make sooner or later. And he said, we only got one or two choices. Stay powerless, drink until we die, or be willing to accept spiritual help. One of the favorite sayings in AA today is, don't talk too much about God or you'll run the newcomer off. Big Book doesn't mind talking about God. Certainly does not mind telling us that we really have only one or two choices. My old sponsor helped me in this area. He said, Charlie, you don't need to worry about running a newcomer off talking about God. He said, if you do, whiskey will put him right back in here every time. He said, you don't have any place else to go. And when he comes back, he might be ready to talk about God. A textbook never tells you anything but what it doesn't back it up. Now, we've been told of the need for the vital spiritual experience. Let's look at an example on page 26. Where this came from. A certain American businessman had ability, good sense, and high character. Now, this is the guy named Roland Hazard. For years, he had floundered from one sanitarium to another. He had consulted the best-known American psychiatrist. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of a celebrated physician, the psychiatrist Dr. Jung, who prescribed for him. Though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. Now, he didn't go to Dr. Jung for a 28-day treatment program. He stayed a full year with Dr. Jung. His mental and physical condition were unusually good. Above all, he believed he'd acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. Nevertheless, he was drunk in a short time. More baffling still, he could give himself no satisfactory explanation for his fall. So he returned to this doctor whom he admired and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to regain self-control. He seemed quite rational and well-balanced with respect to other problems, yet he had no control whatever over alcohol. Why was this? He begged the doctor to tell him the whole truth, and he got it. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position in society, and would have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was a great physician's opinion. But this man still lives and is a free man. He does not need a bodyguard, nor is he confined. He can go anywhere on this earth where other free men may go without disaster, provided he remains willing to maintain a certain simple attitude. Now, some of our alcoholic readers may think they can do without spiritual help. Let us tell you the rest of the conversation our friend had with his doctor. The doctor said, "You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you." Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, "Is there no exception?" "Yes," replied the doctor, "there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomenal. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements.
Change.
Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding force of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side.
Change.
And a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them.
Change.
In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you.
Change.
With many individuals, the message which I employed are successful, or I've never been successful with an alcoholic to your description, asterisk, bottom of the page, for amplification, see Appendix 2.
Change.
They want to be sure that we understand that this spiritual experience is nothing more than a change in our personality where old ideas are cast aside and replaced with a new set of ideas. Now think of the humility of this doctor. You know, here is a doctor who is trained in the matters of the mind. Here is a doctor that has spent his entire lifetime dealing with the mind. Here is a doctor that is great enough to say, "Roland, I can't do anything else for you. You're going to die from alcoholism." And Roland said, "Doctor, isn't there any exception to that?" And the doctor said, yeah. "Once in a great while, I've seen people like you recover through a vital spiritual experience." Normally he would have said, "Roland, I believe you're suffering from a Valium deficiency. Here's a prescription. Come back and see me in 30 days. You know, I think this is another great, great miracle. Roland intended to go to Dr. Freud. Freud was so busy that he couldn't get to him. Freud and Jung had fallen apart, broken up, because of Jung's ideas about spirituality. Freud didn't want any part of that. Roland had to go to Dr. Jung, who happened to be the one that believed in spirituality. Surely, surely, this is one of our great miracles behind our whole fellowship.
Now, we don't know for sure, but we assume that Dr. Jung probably said, Roland, you ought to get in some kind of spiritual deal somewhere. Roland came back to the States, got in the Oxford groups, used their program, had a spiritual experience, recovered, and then went to see the judge to get Eddie out and told Eddie what Jung had told him, and then Eddie recovered and told Bill what Roland had told him that Jung had told him. The idea of the need for the vital spiritual experience came from a psychiatrist on the other side of the world. The idea of the problem came from a doctor there in New York City. And we're always talking about those doctors know nothing about us. We're talking about those psychiatrists know nothing about us. But our problem and our solution came from a doctor in New York City, a doctor on the other side of the world, who, by the way, both happen to be non-alcoholics, Joe.
Okay. As these things were made together through these circumstances, and then the program of recovery came to Bill. And Bill was said he was, his mind was a vessel to gather these ideas from other people. They did not originated in his mind. They originated in the mind of Dr. Silkworth, step one, Dr. Carl Jung, step two, and the program of action of the Oxford groups. Bill received all three of these things and put them down in a form for alcoholics. And this became the 12 steps on the program of recovery.
We have looked at three things basically in the big book. We looked at the problem, and that problem came from the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. We looked at the solution, and we found that in that solution, we have two powers, the power of the fellowship, the power of the vital spiritual experience. And through describing we alcoholics, and through describing that our real problem centers in the mind rather than the body, we've looked at the idea that none of us are probably going to be able to stay sober without having that vital spiritual experience. And I can see Bill as he finishes up chapter two. I can see him kind of set back and again review what he's accomplished up to this point. And I can see him saying that they're not going to care about that vital spiritual experience any more than I did. Remember, Bill's a real alcoholic. And remember, he had an aversion to anything that even slightly resembled religion. And I think he knew exactly how we were going to feel. So I think he says to himself, what I need to do is tell them a little bit more about this alcoholism thing and drive home this point that without the vital spiritual experience, we're simply not going to be able to survive. And he wrote another chapter called More About Alcoholism. And in this chapter, he talks about one thing and one thing only. Step two says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, if we need to be restored to sanity, then that indicates we're insane. And that's exactly what this chapter is about. The insanity that we need to be restored from. Now, many alcoholics say, well, I have no trouble with the insanity because I remember all the crazy, stupid things I did while drinking. No, that has nothing to do with insanity. The crazy, stupid things we did while drinking is caused by a mind filled with alcohol, which lowers the inhibitions. And if your mind is filled with alcohol and the inhibitions have been lowered, look out, you're probably going to do some pretty crazy, stupid things. But that's caused by alcohol. Sanity is defined as wholeness of mind. Insanity is defined as a mind less than whole. Has nothing to do with craziness. You know, if you're crazy, that means you've lost more than half your marbles, and you're going to have to be locked up somewhere to protect you and society.
But insanity simply means a mind that is less than whole. One of the best ways I know to illustrate it would be if I had a good pie in front of me. And if I had cut that pie into 10 pieces and you come along and take a piece of that pie, my pie is now less than whole, but I've still got 90% of it. And somebody else comes along and takes a piece of pie, my pie is still more or less than whole, but I've still got 80% of it. Insanity does not mean you're all gone. It just means you're not quite all here. And it seems as though when it comes to alcohol, we're not always quite all here. Let's begin to look at the idea of insanity being a mind less than whole, a mind that's not quite all here, or a mind that cannot always see the truth about something. Joe?
Okay, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drink careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Remember, we said an obsession is an idea that overcomes all other ideas. And in some cases, that obsession can make you believe something that is not true. Okay. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. And then we see Bill again using words, and he uses a different word here. He says illusion. Now we know an illusion is we see something that is not true. So it's the same thing as obsession or to believe a lie. We learn that we had to fully concede our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people are present has to be smashed. Now he uses another word again. He's repeating himself. He says a delusion. Now we can delude our minds to believe something that is not true. Or we can have an illusion, or we can have an obsession, or all of them deal with insanity, which is to believe something that is not true. And that's the state of the mind just before we drink. Just before we drink, we could say we had an obsession, we could say we had an illusion, or we can say we had deluded our thinking. So just before we go in the bar or in the liquor store to buy a drink, we would have to be under that state of mind. We cannot go in the bar, an alcoholic cannot go in the bar or the liquor store on the truth. It's totally impossible for me to go in there today on the truth. I would have to walk in the bar and say, hey, mister, I drank some of that 30 years ago and it damn near killed me and I ended up locked up in the state hospital. Now this morning I would got some money. I would like to buy some more of that to do the same thing. You know what I mean? See, you just can't drink on that. But if I could delude my thinking or become involved in an illusion or obsession, I could walk in there believing it would be all right. And that would be an insane thing. So this is what we're looking at when we look at insanity.